you'll notice that people get real specific when they're after something versus people that are just in pain. They're like, I don't care. I don't care if it's a cold bucket of water. Whatever it takes to make me not hurt, I'll take. Versus people that go, no, I'm allergic to, and they list off 12 things, but for some reason,
that landmark,
I am great with oxycodone. Yeah. Exactly. All of a sudden, you're like, oh.
The one that starts with D. What's that one? D.
That's the famous one.
Welcome to another episode of Up My Nursing Game, the educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. Please claim your free CE credit for listening to this episode through BCU Health. See the link in the show notes. I'm going to start this episode off with a quick request. Like all medical education providers, I need your feedback to make sure that I'm producing quality material that is relevant to your educational needs. I'm asking all of my listeners to complete a brief survey that will give me a better understanding of who you are and what topics you'd like me to discuss in future episodes. This survey will be active until the end of May, so I'll be reminding you over the next few episodes to participate as well. Go to the podcast website, upmynursinggame.com, or simply use the link in the show notes to complete the survey. At the end of May, I'll choose one lucky participant to receive a handmade nursing cap as a thank you. Okay, so moving on. I'm excited to share a super interesting interview I recorded with two fellow nursing podcasters about the opioid crisis. This topic was requested by my fellow listeners who wanted some context about the current crisis that we're facing in the U.S. Ben and Tom from Just Some Podcasts for Advanced Practitioners join me for a candid discussion of the current opioid crisis, how it started, drug-seeking behaviors, and how to practice safely and responsibly. Before we begin, I want to remind you, my highly motivated listeners, that this podcast has partnered with Nicole Kupchick, who does amazing online, on-demand courses for essential subjects such as stroke, ABGs, mechanical ventilation, and hemodynamics, to name a few. Nicole has extended a 20% discount to listeners, so please use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off her books and courses. All right, on with the show. Welcome, Ben Cochran and Tom Shore to Up My Nursing Game. Tom and Ben, I met them at the Nurses PodCon last November in Tennessee, and they host a podcast called Just Some Podcasts. They're nurse practitioners out of, is it Ohio now? Where are you guys?
So we're actually separate. I am in Ohio and Ben is in Kansas.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
No way. I thought you two were like next door neighbors.
No, we just argue like we are.
So. Got it. So welcome. I'm so happy to have you here today.
And we're glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Ben, I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about yourself and your background in nursing.
Well, I started nursing in the emergency room and then I transitioned and did some emergency preparedness work while I worked in the emergency room. And while I was going to school to get my nurse practitioner, I stepped out because I wanted to be away from patients and get away from that clinical mindset to focus on the clinician mindset. So I took a job in IT working directly with all of our providers on the EHR system that we use. And then I got my nurse practitioner and I've done some ER, done some prison healthcare, done family practice, which is where I do most of my work now. And yeah, that's pretty much me.
That's awesome. And it was when you were working in the ER as a nurse that you met Tom?
I've actually known Tom for about 20 years now.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, we both have law enforcement experience and I used to be a dispatcher years and years ago. And so we've kind of met through different things, but yeah, it's been about 20, 25 years that we've known each other.
All right. And Tom, I'll hand this over to you. Tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, and especially as a
pertains to nursing.
So as Ben said, you know, I started in law enforcement and I got to know the nursing staff in the local emergency room really well. And I decided, hey, I don't like to get shot at anymore. So I traded in my vest for pajamas and got some scrubs. I started in a level 2 trauma ICU, which is not something I would ever suggest to a brand new baby nurse. I would never just say start there. It was a unique position or a unique time, I should say. But so I kind of, that's where I started and got into an ER. Did ER work for a while, became a trauma program and stroke program manager, did all that work. And yeah, just decided I wanted to continue my education and became a nurse practitioner. Now I do family practice and, you know, see patients, and it's been a wild ride. I've seen a lot of different things and I've just been everywhere. It feels like, I feel like I've done like a little bit of everything.
That's quite a diverse background, I think. And I remember when I was chatting with you at the Nurses PodCon, you described this patient you had who needed an IO. They were like in the trauma bay and you were, yeah. You had the drill going, and then the family member who insisted on watching was starting to faint and you held him up with your other hand while you were drilling in with the other. And in my head, I don't think I said it at the time, but I was like, I can't believe he gave that up to become an NP.
Well, yeah, no, so first of all, that was a weird day. That did happen. Yeah, he just insisted, no, I'm not leaving my brother. I was like, okay. And when I started putting that IO in his shin bone, the guy that was standing there, he started to go out. So yeah, that was a fun time. But I honestly love and in times miss action like that. But it wasn't so much I wanted to give that up. It's that I wanted to continue to develop myself. And so the next step is, once I start learning about something, I just tend to keep digging. And so in nursing, it became, well, the more I learned, it just got to the point where the next step was to become a provider myself. So it wasn't so much I didn't like it. It was more, that was just the evolution that, you know, I went down.
Absolutely. Yeah, I get it. Speaking of your varied background, like I'd like to hear a little bit more about your podcast.
Ben is the complete backbone of Just Some Podcast for Advanced Practitioners. It's true. However, I was just thinking about one day, I was like, Ben, we should do a podcast. And he's like, what? And so we just kept talking about it and we kind of blew it off for, God, almost a year. And then finally one day he's like, okay, put this on your computer. This is what we're going to try. And here we are. So
yeah, that's pretty much how that started. So, and the idea behind it was we wanted to have a podcast directed at advanced practitioners, PAs and NPs, because there wasn't a big niche market out there for education for them. But we also wanted to be educational without reading PowerPoints and kind of droning on. So we wanted it to be more entertaining. So the way that we look at it is it's kind of like you're sitting in the break room and you're kind of conversing with everybody. So it's kind of that break room talk, but you're still learning stuff along the way. And so we've been doing that for about 3 years now. And so then we launched a new podcast also last month called We'll Continue to Monitor, which is our kind of our medical mystery podcast. So lots of fun stuff going on over at Just Some Podcast.
Yeah, that's awesome. So it's kind of a mix of medical mystery and education, it sounds like.
Well, you know, again, Ben also, I got to give him some credit. He's kind of the one that when I was bedside nursing and I'm like, I'm learning a lot, but I feel like there's more I can do. He was like, bro, go back to school, get your NP. And so it kind of just kept developing over time. So yeah, this is where we are.
Yeah, so. That's awesome. And this really unique background of yours, I thought was such a great opportunity for me to talk to you two about, you know, a big issue in not just nursing today and not just medical, but in you know, national news and policy right now is the opioid epidemic.
Yeah.
And I know this is something that, you know, nurses have come up to me with that they'd like to understand it more, some more of like the historical context of the crisis, and especially how it pertains to us as nurses and what we need to know, what we need to do about it. And I know you two did a two-part episode on this already, and I'm just so happy and grateful to have you here today to talk about it with the Up My Nursing Game podcast. So first, I'd like to just ask, like, you describe this as a passion of yours, the opioid crisis and, you know, the education surrounding it. So Tom and Ben, I just like to know, like, what makes you so passionate about this topic?
So where I live in Ohio, well, and first of all, just Ohio in general, has just really taken a punch over the opioid crisis. As a matter of fact, when we were talking pre-show a little bit, my specific area was basically considered like ground zero at one point for a part of the crisis. So I have seen it up close and personal, both as an ER nurse and an ER supervisor, and then now in my practice, taking care of patients. It is something that touches my life either directly or indirectly every day. So it is extremely important to me and those around me. I mean, I have family members that have been affected by this. I have patients, family members. There's not really anywhere I can go that this doesn't touch me on a daily basis. And so you just get into that mindset and frame where this is something you have to deal with. And then, like you said, we did the episode for our show because it was affecting both of us as providers. And so we decided to get into it. So yeah, I've seen it on the law enforcement side, not so much opiate, but drug addiction and abuse in general. And then now in medicine, it has really ramped up and been more focused on opiate abuse.
And mine, I think I actually went to a seminar one time that had a retired DEA agent, and he spent several hours talking about opioids and the opioid crisis and everything. And it was just very interesting. And then learning more about the historical stuff about it as well was very interesting to me. And, you know, in the area that I'm in, yes, opioids are pretty prevalent. And so it has definitely changed the way that I practice and ensure that my patients are safely handling things, I guess would be the best way to word that.
Yeah, it's always a tricky, like,
right. It's always a fine line, right, of getting patients comfortable enough that they can lead, you know, a productive life while, you know, always being mindful of the addiction aspect.
And I feel Ben's going to say something similar, but I don't want my patients ever in pain. However, there's also that fine line where you have to go, look, you're getting to the point where this may not be the healthiest treatment option. There are other things we should probably pursue to get your pain under control other than just jamming pills down your mouth. Some people are very happy to hear that, but there are other people like, no, I just want a pill. And I'm like, no. And so that leads to some friction sometimes with patients. Because again, I don't want to be in pain. I don't want anybody else to be in pain. But I have to make a final judgment on what's best for your safety and health. And sometimes pills aren't it. So it is, like I said, it's a daily conversation I have at some point with somebody.
Well, and the other thing is you have to be very realistic with your patients about the expectations of opioids, even if you're considering short-term or long-term, you know, particularly long-term, it's, you know, this is not going to be a magic pill that's going to make all your pain go away. This is to make it more manageable so that you can still function as a normal, quote-unquote normal human being. And so, you know, they, you know, if we can get your pain from a 8 or a 9 down to a 3 or a 4 and you're able to go to work and function, then that's what we're looking for, as opposed to just this magic pill that just makes life all better.
Again, I don't want to armchair quarterback this too much and cast shadow or doubt on what people did prior to the epidemic. But I would say that far too often it seems like they were just like, oh, I'll just give you this pill and everything will go away. Instead of having a real conversation, being like, look, you're probably always going to have a 1 out of 10. Okay, so here's what we can do. But they want magic, and sometimes that's just not possible. And I think in a lot of ways that helped contribute to developing the crisis as we have it today.
Yeah. You know, I did a bit of research going into this episode because I didn't myself have much of, you know, a understanding of the historical context of this. But it sounds like, you know, the history of opioids is as old as this country, and that it's gone back to, you know, the early days in America when women were prescribed opiates for pain and then they became addicted to it. And there, you know, there's always been this kind of ebb and flow of opioid addiction with, you know, different patient populations at different eras. But in this current crisis that we're in right now, I was wondering if you could just give us like some context for how it all began and how it influenced where we are now.
As far as the specific crisis that, you know, we talked a little bit pre-show about, the big thing is going to be the mass marketing of pain relief medications. The big one that everyone's going to know is OxyContin. And OxyContin wasn't alone, but by far it was the upfront and main one that caused all these issues. Some of it was prescribing practices that caused the issue, and some of it was just flat lying by Purdue Pharma. And because a lot of the information that doctors were getting at that time was, this is great. It's going to fix all your patients' problems that are going to have no side effects. It's not addictive. And you should just shove this pill down everyone's face. And so they started. And then patients, of course, were going, hey, I feel fantastic and I have no pain at first, you know, and then all of a sudden you fast forward a couple of years and doctors started going, hey, wait a second. I'm starting to see a lot of problems. And Purdue was like, no. There's no problems. Like, you clearly are misunderstanding the data. There's not really a problem. And so the problem for us as medical providers and healthcare in general became, we had already let the cat out of the bag. Like, we had already started the epidemic without knowing we had started the epidemic. And so by the time we recognized the problem and what we had to do to fix it, we're here. Like, we started figuring this out, but we're already, you know, 10, 15 years into the problem. When we go, we got to fix this. It's kind of hard to put the toothpaste back into the tube once, you know, you've got it out.
Yeah. And then there was a couple of other things that we kind of went into on our show that caused this. And, you know, opioids have been around since probably the dawn of time. I mean,
yeah, I mean, literally.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, there are Facebook memes and stuff of like cough syrups back in, you know, 1800s that had heroin in them, or for children, because it made them quit coughing. So, I mean, it's not always been, you know, and so there's always been opioids there. Part of the problem is, in the United States and the other country in the world, I think it's either Australia or New Zealand, I don't remember off the top of my head now, pharmaceutical companies are allowed to directly market to consumers. So you see all these pill commercials that, oh, this will solve your depression and this will solve your dry eye syndrome or whatever, you know. And so it's transitioned us to a very pill-based society. And people want the pill to make themselves feel better. The other big thing that caused some of the epidemic that we're in now, as far as the opioid crisis, is, and I might take some hate for this one, but it was making pain the fifth vital sign.
I'll just say I completely agree with you.
Because once we made that a vital sign, and then once we started getting dinged through JCO or through other places because we weren't effectively addressing their pain, then you've set us up for failure, because now we have to address their pain. So, I mean, it was a conglomerate of bad things that kind of caused this tornado. But I mean, yeah, like Tom said, you know, it's kind of trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
So it sounds like OxyContin was kind of the start of our current crisis here, where patients were overprescribed OxyContin because physicians believed or chose to believe that it was safe and non-addictive. So fast forward to where we are today, what does the opioid crisis look like? Because we're no longer prescribing OxyContin. Like, I think I've seen it prescribed once in my 7 years as a nurse. Can you talk about kind of how we went from OxyContin to where we are today?
Well, so to be fair, OxyContin or derivatives that are similar to it are still being prescribed. There is a lot of bureaucracy and red tape now, which is both good and bad, depending on how you look at it, on how providers are allowed to prescribe these pain medications. And it is different per state. Okay, so I know you have listeners all over the country. So for people in California, for people in Colorado, people in Florida, people in Ohio, there's actually different rules. Okay, so again, there is no one-size-fits-all answer that's going to help all this. But basically where we're at now is, it feels like to me that we have tried to make it harder for people that are drug seeking to get the medication. But all that's led to, at least in my area, has led to black market, a proliferation of these medications, or outright illegal drug use.
Well, and you know, like you said, OxyContin is still being used, but one of the big changes that has been made through pain medications, especially the longer acting ones like OxyContin was, is they have started to put fillers into the medication so that if the medication is crushed or the medication is somehow misused, then it completely voids the medication, which I think is an interesting aspect because that's one of the things that they found with OxyContin was that they could, you know, crush it up and then instead of it lasting 12 hours, it's an immediate high.
Yeah. And so that was part of the fallacy in the beginning was they said, oh, it's got this enteric coating and they can't possibly get high because it's going to do all this stuff. Well, if a person really wants to get addicted to a substance, they'll find a way. And so that's what they did is they just started crushing it up. And then when they found some new additive, they would just find ways around it. So that's kind of the progression to now is that people got smart about how to get around the safeguards that Purdue was putting into, like, you know, OxyContin in this case.
Okay. So what is like a common pathway to addiction today? Is it usually that a patient is prescribed a pain medication and then it's pulled away from them and then they go to the black market? Like, I think as law enforcement officers, like maybe you could have a little bit of insight to what this pathway to addiction looks like.
Well, I think the biggest factor in the pathway to addiction is the mental health of the person, whether that's not being treated or whether they are self-medicating, depression, anxiety, whatever the case may be. And, you know, or maybe they just have a bad life and so they just want to not think about it for the 5 hours that they're shooting up heroin or whatever the case may be. So I think you have that mental health aspect that's untreated and it's grossly undertreated in this country. And then they get opioids, or maybe they break their foot or whatever the case may be. You prescribe opioids appropriately to address that. They like that feeling. They start seeking that feeling out. So then, you know, you hear stories of people breaking bones and going to physicians or providers just to get more opioids. And then it kind of cycles from there to, well, I can't get it there, so I'll start buying it off the street. Well, then it's cut with other things. Or, well, now, you know, I can get OxyContin for $10 a pill, but I can get heroin for $3. So then I'm going to start using heroin. And so it just progresses from there.
For me, the pathway to addiction, it seems like a fork in the road type situation. At least that's been my experience so far, is that either a person is going to get addicted from illegal substances, or like you were just talking about, you know, they get injured and they get appropriately prescribed medication. And then it becomes an addiction from there. And again, this leads back to the fifth vital sign issue for me. And I think that's a big problem with this is because a lot of people that once they get addicted to something, they'll do what they want to try and get that. And I think sometimes they're like, well, I'm just going to keep complaining about my pain and you're not treating it appropriately. And some providers go, well, I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want a bad Prescani score. I don't want to have to talk to administration. So I'll just give them another week's worth of, you know, whatever pain medication they're on at that point, you know, Percocet, whatever. So I think it just begets itself. You know, once they get hooked on a substance, whether it's illicit or not, they just want to continue to find a way. And honestly, the underlying factor of all this is mental health, as Ben already pointed out.
Yeah. On a previous podcast episode, me and my guests kind of shared our stories with taking opiates that were prescribed and just both saying like, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And, but we both were in a good mental state and we both had the knowledge and education of how addicting these pain medications were. And it was like, on the one hand, amazing. And on the second hand, terrifying. That like, wow, I like this so much. This is scary. And and because we knew like where it could lead, like just really walking away from the situation and just really done with it as soon as we could.
And to be completely honest, most people, the vast majority of people, that's the experience they're going to have. They're like, wow, I could see how people get addicted to this. But once they're out of pills, they just go, okay, I'm out of pills. You know, they just move on with their life. It's the people that get addicted to it that go, no, I need more. That whatever it is that's not clicking doesn't click over and say, all right, well, get up and go to work tomorrow. They go, oh, well, my foot's still hurting. I really need it. Do they? That's kind of the clinician's job to start, you know, sussing out is this something that they really need or not? But again, I think that's where it begins. I will tell you, I've had similar, I mean, I haven't been prescribed opiates a bunch in my life, but a couple times, I do remember the very first time I had a similar, and I know Ben's heard this story. I was a young police officer, no medical training whatsoever other than basic CPR and stuff like that. And I had got a really rocking case of bronchitis. And I don't remember who prescribed me codeine cough syrup. And again, it was totally appropriate. And looking back, I would still say this had nothing to do with the prescriber. This is completely my lack of knowledge. So on the label, it said, you know, 1 to 2 teaspoons every so many hours as needed, blah, blah, blah. So I was young, single, in an apartment. I think I had like 3 spoons to my name. And they were all tablespoons, by the way. So I take a couple tablespoons of this cough syrup. Oh, no. And I'm like, oh, I'm a big guy. Nothing else happened. I'll just take some more within like 30 minutes. Fast forward a couple hours. I'm sitting on my couch going, I don't think I can move. I don't understand. Like, people were coming over to my apartment like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, not a damn thing. Like, I'm just going to sit here and ride this roller coaster out. And so it was, not to sound bad, but it was fun. I was like, man, I feel fantastic. Like, I felt like I could do anything in the world, and I wasn't coughing. So I was like, hey. But on the flip side, I remember really bad sprained ankle. And I got a couple of days worth of Norco, which is hydrocodone and acetaminophen. And I was terrified to take it. Everyone kept telling me, oh, if you take that, you're going to get loopy and all this other stuff. And I was like 8 out of 10 pain. Couldn't walk, couldn't bear weight. But I was like, I don't want to get, you know, addicted. I don't want to. Again, this is pre me having any medical knowledge. And I finally took one. And I will say, here's one of the things, though, you have to learn about this crisis. Not every opiate feels the same, because codeine makes me loopy as all get out. I took Norco. It was like taking really great ibuprofen. I didn't feel loopy. My pain went away, but it did exactly what it was intended to do. It made my pain go down, and I didn't have any after effects. So that was also a thing for me, is not every opiate is equal. And so that's also part of drug-seeking behavior, which I think we're going to talk about later, is you'll notice that people get real specific when they're after something, versus people that are just in pain. They're like, I don't care. I don't care if it's a cold bucket of water. Whatever it takes to make me not hurt, I'll take.
Yeah.
Versus people that go, no, I'm allergic to, and they list off 12 things, but for some reason,
that landmark,
I am great with oxycodone. Yeah, exactly.
Oxycodone is like, good. Oh. The one that starts with D. What's that one? D.
Yeah, that's the famous one. Yeah. Lauded in the ER. When you hear someone go, what's that one? And you're like, don't say it. So I'll tell that story later on. But I got fooled one time right up to that point, and I was like, oh, I just had like this sad look in my face, like, they had me. They did. I feel like I have a pretty good lie detector built in after police work and ER nursing. But this one patient, they just got by me right till then. And then I was just like, I was so sad. I was just like, oh.
Yeah, you were almost fooled.
Yeah, you had me right till then.
So. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about drug-seeking behavior. And I'm sure, you know, as, you know, bedside nurses, you were seeing this, but as providers now, I can imagine that you're seeing this and then having to make the decision one way or the other. Yeah, so yeah, like kind of starting it in an emergency, like how would you see this present?
I have seen a variety of interesting things for people who were trying to obtain narcotics. I've seen people go as far as unhooking their IV enough to put blood, to get a drop of blood to put into their urine so that they look like they had a kidney stone. I've seen, which we caught that one, obviously. And
yeah.
We had a gentleman who had checked in, that he checked in with his complaint of, you know, he was kind of roughhousing with his kid and his kid jumped on his ribs. And I was like, I've heard this story before. I know I've heard this. And so I kind of did some searching. And a couple weeks before that, someone else with a different name had checked in with that exact same complaint. So this guy was using a fake name to try to get narcotics. We ended up detaining him until police arrived, because at that point you're, you know, identity theft.
I see. So it's illegal.
Yeah. So yeah, as bedside, I've seen a lot of, like I said, very interesting ways of them trying to get that. And of course, as a provider, you hear literally every possible story, excuse for how those pills got lost, stolen, down the toilet, down the sink. My dog ate them.
Oh, yeah. But the dog's fine somehow. The dog's not in a coma, but the dog ate them. For me, first of all, you have to kind of know your area. Not everywhere's the same. I'm sure where I work at now isn't the same as where you're at now. So you kind of got to know your area. But I would tell you, overwhelmingly for me, both at bedside and as a provider, some of the stuff that keys in, and I know, overly specific or overly vague.
Okay.
Like if they say, oh, I am, for specifics, we go back to the original thing we just talked about. I'm allergic to Tylenol. I'm allergic to Motrin. I'm allergic to Naprosyn. I'm allergic to this. I'm allergic to that. But Percocet, I'm fine. And then when you say, but Percocet, and I loved doing this. Oh boy, I love doing this. I'm like, so you could take Percocet, but you can't take Tylenol. Nope, totally allergic to Tylenol. I'm like, but Percocet has Tylenol. Oh, what, the opiate cancels it out, so I can take that. Oh, okay. Or on the flip side, it's overly vague. When I was at bedside, you'd give them, okay, I'll give you a 30 of Toradol. You know, whatever they order, you know. And, oh, it's just not helping. I'm like, 30 of Toradol didn't, you know, take away shoulder pain? I'm like, okay. And so they just keep going until they hit something. Now, they never specifically say it, but they just make it, they kind of railroad you into that's the only option. Is either you kick them out or you give them, you know, fentanyl. You know, it's one or the other. And so that's why I say, when I say overly specific or overly vague, like that's the type of things. Also, the behavior itself sometimes is like some of the keys. And again, this happens a lot as a provider, is they sometimes will get very forceful. Well, no, you're not helping me. You're not doing, and they will very much try to make you feel like you are causing their issue. You're not helping me. You're not giving me medication. You're not helping me feel better. So like, okay, that's a person that has one thing on their mind. And if you don't fulfill it, they plan on causing a problem. And so I would tell any person that's becoming a provider, or if you're new to bedside nursing or not, you know, but if you start to see that type of behavior, you need to steel yourself. Like, okay, you need to know that a person that is doing that is also mentally preparing themselves for a fight. And I don't always mean physical, sometimes not, but they are targeting, and that's a targeting behavior. They are setting this up so that there's a confrontation, because they also know that in healthcare, and again, this goes back to that fifth vital sign issue, that if they cause a big enough stink, that somebody is probably going to come in and tell them, just make it go away. Give them what they want so that this isn't a problem. And that sounds sad, but that's also true.
It's hospitals, so frustrating.
It is. It's extremely frustrating. Very frustrating. So I like to tell people, is one of the behaviors, since you know, like those are some of the things that I would look for. I mean, because I can't tell you any specific, they're always going to say this. I can tell you behaviors though. Like those are the things that you want to watch for. The best way to prevent those types of issues is having a routine, for me at least, and this is how I teach when I teach nurse practitioner students, is have a set routine that you stick with. Like, I'm very clear with all my patients the very first time I meet them, or if we're talking about pain, I'm very specific about expectations. Like, here are the medications that we want to talk about. And I never take anything off the board right off the bat. Like, I like to keep all my options open, and that includes opiates. But there's a very clear discussion about what we want as both a patient and a provider, because it's a we situation at that point. What are we looking to get out of this? Like, you know, what do you expect and what am I going to provide? And then don't bluff and stick to your guns. If you say, I am not, you know, like based on the fact that this is a 6-week-old shoulder injury, you know, I'm not going to give you Norco or Percocet, and then stick to those guns. And honestly, people that are usually drug seeking, once they realize that if you say those series of things and you stick to it, they will stop. I've had patients that I know have gone other places. They still come to me, but they don't come to me for stuff like that. You know, they're like, I still need my lisinopril, but they don't talk to me about pain medications. And that's not bad. That's just, they're not trying to do that. And so one last thing I would say, because of the mental health issue with this, is usually people that are drug seeking, they also get into a pattern themselves. So suddenly when they get in the room, if you watch their behavior, it will change depending on where it's going. So if they're not getting what they want, suddenly you can be like, man, this was such a great visit. Or if you're bedside, this patient has been a kitten the whole time. You know, they've been so well behaved. And then when they don't get what they want, it's a completely different person. And again, you have to take the context of the entire situation. But if they're looking for pain medication, you're like, well, the doctor said 800 milligrams of ibuprofen and they blow up. That's something I would be like, okay, this is probably a bigger issue than just this point right now.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that, like I'll describe as manipulative behavior too, where patients will say, well, this nurse gave me medication or this doctor provided this in the past and now you're not doing that. Kind of like pitting people against each other.
Yeah, very much so.
Absolutely.
As providers, like how much can you see in a patient's medical record about their previous prescriptions of opiates?
So in Kansas, we have what we call KTRAX, which is the prescription monitoring service. So anything that is prescribed, and it's not just Kansas. I mean, it's across multiple states that we can actually view. I think I have like 20 states that I can query against and see what prescriptions were written, and those are any controlled substance, but it also includes other ones like gabapentin. It's not a controlled substance, but it still is listed on there. So, and I've had patients who've come in and said, well, no, I've not been prescribed anything, you know, and then you K-track them and like, well, that's not entirely true because I see here like 5 days ago you got a prescription. So, and then so there's a lot of those ways that we're trying to prevent that doctor shopping and things like that to get multiple prescriptions from multiple providers.
Yeah, we have a similar thing called ORS in Ohio. Same exact thing. It's just different name. But like Ben said, the doctor shopping can also be something you have to watch for. Unless you sent this person to a psychiatrist, if they're getting benzodiazepines from somebody, you're going to be like, okay, wait a second. So you come to me when you have pain, but you go to them for something else. That may or may not be the correct answer. So I don't ever want to say one size fits all in this type of situation, but that's certainly the type of sign that I would say requires more investigation. Like, is this a legitimate issue?
And as a provider, the other thing I do with my patients that I have on any controlled substance, whether it be Adderall or a benzo or opioids, is we have a controlled substance contract. And it specifically lays out what the expectations are. And some of those expectations are if your medication is lost, stolen, whatever, we're not replacing that. There's no early refills. There's no, it's a weekend. The expectations are this is what it is. It also puts them under the gun that they have to do random drug screens whenever it's requested. And I can also request pill counts. And that's what this opioid crisis has pushed providers to make sure that we're prescribing medication appropriately.
While I agree with a lot of things that we have to do now, I don't agree with all of them. I think it really sucks for some patients that are legitimately in a bad situation. And I'm like, look, you know, these are the rules now, and I'm not going to break the rules, you know, in any case for that. I have a very similar, you know, methodology in our practice. I've had my house was on fire. I'm like, okay, well, I better see you. I need some kind of proof. Like, you better get a fireman. You better get a police officer with a report number. I got to have something. I'm not just giving you. It's amazing how many times you don't get a call back. Well, I was in a car wreck and I lost all my medication. Okay, I need a report number so I can verify with the police department. And then suddenly, you never get a call back. You never get a report number. So it does happen.
And it's never lisinopril that's lost or stolen.
Yeah, it's amazing. Or if it's not their first time, they'll do that. They'll be like, well, I did lose my lisinopril, but I also lost. And you're like, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. So it's amazing how nobody ever loses or dog never eats an entire bottle of ibuprofen. But boy, they sure do seem to really go for those opiates.
It's a great point that you bring up that patients are always missing or having their opioids stolen, but not their other medications.
Well, but part of that is because if you look back at that pathway of addiction, if they're not able to get that through a provider, the next step is, well, you know, I know that so-and-so has...
Jim has it.
Yeah, I know he has medication, and so I can break into his house and steal his, and then it's his problem, not mine, because then I got my fix.
but nobody ever seems to lose Farxiga. So that is a good thing to key in on. Like, so they didn't steal that metformin, but they got your opiate. Yeah. So, I mean, the crappy part is Ben's correct. Like, there are cases where that may be legitimate. I think it's just incumbent on the medical professional to say, okay, well, here's all the evidence and make a decision. And the other thing I would really like people to hear is you're going to make mistakes. As both a medical provider, as a bedside nurse, stuff is going to happen. I try and tell people, look, if you do your best work and a mistake's still made, then it's made. All right. Like, you can't go back in time, learn from it, move forwards. You know, that's life. It's the constantly not paying attention or making the same mistake more than once or something like that. I'd be like, oh, we need to have a talk. Like, something clearly is wrong in the situation.
Yeah, I mean, you're still going to have people who slip through the crack, and you're still going to have people who trick you, and you just didn't see it coming. And then you have to deal with that, but it happens.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, a good opportunity to kind of point out the fact that, you know, addiction touches everyone. And while, you know, each opioid crisis kind of affects a certain patient population, in general, addiction knows no race, socioeconomic background, religion, anything. And, you know, I've seen personally some amazing people in my life become addicted actually to opioids. And it's not who you usually suspect.
No, it's not. The DEA agent that had to give a seminar that I went to, he said, you know, as a DEA agent, he could spot, he could point out people in the room, you know, oh, that's a methamphetamine addict, or, oh, that's a, you know, he says, but opioid addiction, he said, you can't tell, he says, because these people are functioning mostly appear normal functioning. But he says, I have two words for you if you think that you can spot an opioid addict. And his two words were Rush Limbaugh. He said, because he was an opioid addict and he still produced a show every single day, did everything normal. No one would have ever suspected until he got busted.
That is true. I would say once they get out of, well, I think there are functioning opiate addicts. And then I've seen some ones I'm like, no, well, yeah, it's not going to work. but in general, Ben's 100% correct. I would say the biggest turn when it goes from they realize they can no longer legally get an opiate and they start turning to stuff like heroin or fentanyl off the street, you're going to see a major turn in, you know, behavior at that point usually. But that's also, you're well down the path at that point. Like, that's not, there's no easy fix.
Before we go, I just wanted to talk about one aspect of addiction that I've recently become aware of, which is co-addiction and this kind of relationship between opioids and other substance abuse disorders. And one that I've become aware of is this co-committant opioid and methamphetamine addiction. Is this something that you've seen, like, where you practice?
Oh yeah, lots.
Yeah. And for me, if I pull a direction on a patient and they're positive for methamphetamine, then obviously it's at that point, I just stop prescribing any medication. I mean, not any medication, any controlled substance to them, because of the illicit drug use. But that's part of my contract with my patients. But I know Tom can speak more candidly about the co-addiction part of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, when, especially depending on how far the addiction process has come, again, like he was saying earlier, you have your, and again, I'm not trying to, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, where they are able to manage their day-to-day life. Usually it's the people when you're talking about stuff like heroin with methamphetamines, it's gone to the point where they have downed themselves so much that they use a stimulant like a methamphetamine to just try and right the ship. Instead of getting off of it, getting adequate nutrition and sleep, that's no longer an option. You know, so then the only way to get back into the rotation of trying to function as a normal person is they give themselves an upper. And it just starts leading to this vicious circle where they have to take an upper to stay awake, and then they have to take a downer to get down, and it just becomes back and forth. And sometimes also it's what they can get a hold of. You got to remember, drug flow is, you know, just that, a flow. So sometimes the dealers are going to have heroin, and sometimes they're going to have fentanyl, and sometimes they're going to have meth. Sometimes they have all three, sometimes they have none. So it really does wreak havoc on a abuser's life, because they are also at the mercy of what they can get when they're getting it off the street, which is also why sometimes you see the horrific, you see the people that they wreck their car on purpose so that they can come into an ER and get some pain meds for a couple of days. And you're like, what happened? Or how did a hammer fall into your foot three times? Yeah. That would also be a key thing to listen to, is just listen to the person. When you ask a question, and I know that sounds dumb, but a lot of times, especially in triage, like in an ER situation, people just ask the question and then they just move on. But when you're like, so you twisted your foot, and if you ask them how, you know, because a lot of people, they just say they twisted their foot. They just move on to the next question. What's your height? What's your weight? What's the injury? What's the mechanism? Boom. But if you actually ask a person how and they can't tell you, that would also be something I would say, okay, so you dropped a hammer on your foot. Well, what were you doing? And then they just stare at you. Like, what do you mean? What was I doing? Like, well, were you hanging a picture on your wall? Like, do you just walk around with a hammer? Like, what's going on in your house? You know, so that would also be something. When you ask a person a question, actually listen to the answer. And you'd be surprised what you hear, but that co-addiction process is actually really common. I see it a lot more with stuff like benzodiazepines and opiates, at least in my area. That's how it is. You know, and again, this probably mixes or ties in with the mental health, but they feel like, I could take Zoloft, but I feel a lot better if I take Ativan. And then someone else is like, well, if you take Ativan, you like it, you should try heroin. And then it just kind of becomes this looping circle of mixing medications.
Okay. So are you saying with that, like the benzodiazepine piece, that people just will kind of bounce around between like benzos and opiates?
Again, I can't speak on everything, but my experience and some of the stuff I've been reading. So a lot of times benzodiazepines work really great. As a matter of fact, I'd say in some cases they just work too well. And then people get used to that feeling. And then when we're like, no, this is not appropriate for treatment for you anymore. Or a lot of providers, I know I'm in this camp, is we try and avoid it pretty much at all cost. Like, there are so many other medications with really good outcomes. I don't think a benzodiazepine is the most appropriate for you. And they don't want to hear that. And so what other types of medications can they get? But usually by the point they're trying to talk to their doctor about it, they already know. At least that's been my history, is not very often do patients nowadays, post now that we know what opiates do to people, you don't see a lot of people accidentally getting hooked on benzodiazepines and opiates. Like, that's a pretty big red flag. So I think that's where you start to see a lot of the illicit drug use, is mixing those two things together.
Is there anything else that you guys would like to talk about that you think would be, you know, relevant to this discussion?
Global thermonuclear war.
I think if I talked to my husband about recording this episode, he'd be like, that's so depressing. Like, are you depressed? And I'm like, no, this is just life.
Yeah. Well, I would say some of the things you've already touched on, like, this is going to affect everybody directly or indirectly, whether you're at bedside nursing, whether you're a provider. At some point, you're going to be dealing with stuff like this. So I think, If I had anything else I wanted to talk about with it, I would just say, understand, you know, your area. And again, not everywhere. If you go to San Francisco, of course, there's going to be meth and there's going to be heroin. But what you see, if you actually talk to the people using it, you're going to get slight variations wherever you go. So understanding your patient population is extremely important. And here's the thing. There are a lot of people that are addicted to drugs that are not bad people. All right. They are going through a terrible time in their life. And I would say a large portion of those people don't want to be addicted to drugs. They just don't want to be sick. And now if they don't take heroin, or they don't take Norco, or they don't take Ativan or Xanax or whatever, they get sick. So it's not just identifying them because you don't want to give them medication. It's also identifying them so that you can get them appropriate treatment. And it does work. It is out there. It's a hard road. That's another thing I stress this to my nurse practitioner students. I stress it to new nurses when I train them in the ER. Whether a person likes to hear what you have to say, don't ever lie. I know it sounds really obvious, but a lot of times people, they bend the truth so much that you're like, why did you even say it? You know, like, why did you even go down that road? I try and tell people real quick, real clear, this is going to suck. But here's what you have to do if you want to get better. I've done it with people with alcohol abuse, with drug abuse, but lay it out for them and don't sugarcoat it. That doesn't mean you have to be untactful. It just means you need to be very upfront and very clear about expectations of what you want. And again, that's regardless of bedside, provider. There needs to be clear communication, because these people, especially if they're under the influence, don't expect you're not going to have, you know, lengthy conversations about, you know, what's going on in Ukraine. It ain't going to happen. All right. These people have one thing on their mind, and you need to be able to communicate with a person that is not in a state that most people would want to talk to them in. So being clear, concise, getting to the point, and sticking to your guns, I think is the most important thing for any nurse listening to this and dealing with somebody that's either actively high or trying to get high on drugs. That's the number one thing I'd tell you, is just clear, concise communication and knowing what your rules are, where your ground is, where you're standing, and then stick to it.
That's like a mic drop right there. That was...
Boom. Actually, so I had a CWOP patient yesterday at work. And at one point I said to the provider, he let me know that she has this history of leaving AMA. And I said, but she's really pleasant. And he said, yeah, she always is pleasant. And until she wants to go. And I guess my takeaway from the day was, one, like, addiction happens to good people. And two is that there's something biologically, chemically happening in her brain, in the brain of addicts, that puts them on autopilot to look for drugs. That my patient did not have the mental capacity to do anything except look for alcohol. We were even instructed to remove the hand sanitizer from her room because she had been known to drink the hand sanitizer. Anyway, it was just, it was like such a, not an aha moment, but like a reminder to me that addiction happens to good people. And I really urge nurses and anyone listening to understand the physiology of what's happening, to kind of be able to separate the person from the addiction, to understand what is physically driving them, like chemically driving them to behave the way that they do.
And I guess last thing to say about it is, we talked, Ben and I, about things to watch for. But that's the person that's in that mode. Like, they're in target seeking mode. What you said, though, was equally important, that they are sick. This is a disease process in most cases. And it is real hard for nurses, myself included at times, to separate, like, well, they're just a drug seeker. Well, maybe, but they still deserve care. And that's still a person that deserves, you know, the best professional judgment and attitude that you can give them. It is something that requires treatment. There is no easy way out of it. And I think there's a large mental health component that Ben talked about earlier. I think eventually we will get to a point where we see it more as drug addiction as a disease and treat it as such. We are not there yet. And that's okay, because there is a criminal element to it. And I'm not saying, well, just because you were high, you should be able to get away with crime. Like, no. But like you said, what caused them to get to this point? And is that something that we can fix? And I think for the vast majority of them, yeah, we can. So it is a very tough situation we are in. And unfortunately, in America, we kind of put ourselves in it. Like, we did this ourselves. I read a story by a physician. She was living in Germany and got a hysterectomy. Hmm. You know what they sent her home on? Ibuprofen. Ibuprofen, and they actually told her, please don't use it unless you really need to. And she said, I know damn well in America what I would have went home on. And she goes, you know what? And I'm just fine. I took my 800 ibuprofen occasionally. I drank some warm tea. You know, I rested, and here I am, perfectly normal without ever taking, you know, that type of medication. So I think we have a lot to learn as a society and culture, not just on how we treat patients in pain, but how to prevent addiction and how to treat it. And I don't know when that'll happen, but I hope it happens sooner than later.
Well, and like you said, and as far as like separating the addiction from the person, you know, bedside nursing, ER nursing, whatever the case may be, you still need to remember, like Tom said, you know, even if they're a drug seeker, even if they're a frequent flyer, whatever the case may be, guess what? They still have heart attacks. They still have other things that happen to them medically that they're going to need that care for. So you've got to look beyond that addiction to take care of everything else that may be going on.
Yeah. I told myself that so many times in the ER that I know I've seen this lady 36 times this week, especially when it's cold and they're homeless. Like, oh boy, you know, here she is again. Say she has chest pain because she knows she's going to get back as soon as she says it. But one of these times,
it's going to be real. It's
not. Yeah, it's not. And I told myself, I'm never going to be that guy. I'm not going to let it slip through. So every time, you know, I did the workup just like I was supposed to, even though we all knew, you know, what the outcome was going to be. I made that my professional mindset was, regardless of who it was or how many times we'd seen him or whatever was going, I was going to treat it the way it was supposed to be treated because, yeah, even if they cry wolf 1,000 times, maybe 1,001 is legit. So that's what I hope. If anybody else takes away from it, that's one thing to keep in the back of your head is, yeah, they may be a drug addict, but they could legitimately be having a heart attack or, you know, cellulitis.
Always be vigilant.
Who knows, but something bad could be happening.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Tom and Ben. This has been a really good discussion. I'm so glad we brought in the mental health aspect to this story. And yeah, thank you again for taking the time to be on.
Yeah, anytime. If you find something else, just let us know.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be here.
All right, thanks for listening. Don't forget to claim your free CE credit for this episode by going to BCU Health, whose link is in the show notes, along with a link to the listener survey. That's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.